Welcome back to the program. It is that rare and special event that happens when a life and a time come together in a way that better enables us to understand both. My guest today, Alicia Abbott, has led such a life. Her father, poet, writer, and literary figure Steve Abbott, was one of the early leaders of the gay rights movement, first in Atlanta and then in San Francisco. Alicia's mother would die in a car accident when she was two, and she would be raised by her gay father in 70s San Francisco, long before being a gay parent would become mainstream. Shortly after his death from AIDS in 1992, Alicia would find her father's journals and diaries, and now she tells her story and his in her memoir Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father. It is my pleasure to welcome Alicia Abbott to the program today. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A delight to have you here. Talk a little bit about what your parents' life was like in Atlanta, because in so many ways, as you write about it, it reflected kind of the craziness, the wildness of that period of time.
My parents were very active in the anti-war movement, and I think by the time they met in 1968, they were both sort of self-declared Marxists, and they individually were sort of for an idea of revolution. And revolution, not they were interested in overthrowing the government, but they did feel that the traditional forms of gender relations and family and, you know, forms of society needed to be changed because they were broken. And so when my mother met my father, he described himself as bisexual, and she answered, "Well, that means you can love all of humanity instead of just half of it." And so she was open to that in a way that was very unusual. And in fact, before they married, they even had a semi-open relationship where they would pick up people and sometimes have, you know, group sex, or they later on had lovers on the side, but were still married to each other.
And in many ways, it was a reflection of that idea at the time that the personal and the political really came together in kind of a profound way.
Absolutely. My father would get very involved with gay rights marches, and he founded the local chapter of the Gay Liberation Front. And for him, wearing a dress was a political statement as much as anything. It was about being free to express himself. And I think how they lived their lives, they really wanted to reflect their politics.
And this was, I mean, they were together and I guess got married right before Stonewall happened.
That's right. They got married in February 1969, and Stonewall happened in June of that year.
And talk a little bit about what happened as you've uncovered it and unearthed it through these diaries after your mother's death. You were 2 years old. She died in a car accident with somebody else she was involved with.
Right. At the time, she had a boyfriend. My dad also had a boyfriend, and her boyfriend was arrested for running drugs through Canada, and she went up to bail him out of jail, and this car accident happened on her drive down. So suddenly, my father, who had been, you know, he had been something actually of a house husband while my mother was working. He was at home taking care of me, but suddenly he was a single father, and he had to face a level of responsibility that he didn't have before. And I think it really, as he described it, sort of forced him to grow up. He decided to leave Atlanta for San Francisco, and then in San Francisco was where he could live openly as a gay man.
One of the things you talk about is the ambivalence that he seemed to have about having a child in the first place, and that it was kind of a surprise or a shock to him, and yet he bonded very, very powerfully with you after your mother's death.
Yes, I was not a planned child, and I think that he was ambivalent to the idea of having a child because the kind of life they lived was so free and open, and he thought having a child would change that. But after I was born, and then especially after my mother died, I think he felt that very close with me, and in fact, in his journals wrote that he was all that I had left in the world, and I was all that he had left in the world. So even though my mother's sister, who was living a more traditional suburban life, she'd offered to adopt me, my father said that he wanted to raise me, even if doing so meant he'd be on his own and decided to do that in San Francisco.
And what did your aunt think of that idea?
Oh, I mean, I think she thought, well, that's what he wants. You know, he's not, it's, he obviously felt very strongly that he wanted to raise me, so I don't think she thought to take him away from me. But, you know, I think that there were members of my family who thought I probably would have, might have done better if I'd had lived in a more of a traditional structured family. But my grandparents did take me every summer to give my father a break, and that way they also had somewhat of a hand in raising me. So he wasn't completely on his own 12 months of the year.
From the diaries and journals, what sense did you get of what your father really thought through when he's moved to San Francisco with a young child, and what that would mean for him, and what restrictions it might place on him?
Well, it's interesting because the way in his journals, I also learned a lot about his upbringing, and he was raised in the 1950s, 60s, Nebraska, in a home that was, it was, his family was Catholic and fairly repressed, and people didn't really talk about how they really felt. And I think by the time that he was raising me, he really wanted to have a different approach to family, and he really felt like instead of him sort of changing the way he wanted to live, he wanted to sort of bring me into the life that he wanted. So like I sort of adapted maybe to this almost free-form lifestyle, in the sense that, you know, for example, we had roommates for our first several years in the city, and those roommates would be de facto babysitters and would help raise me as well. So it was, in a way, like a, it was a very alternative family, I guess. But he just saw me as part of the fun, I guess, or the part of the family. He just thought that I could bring my own element of play to the surroundings.
And did you have any sense that this was out of the mainstream in any way? I mean, you were young, you didn't know anything else, and in some ways it must have seemed perfectly normal.
It did seem perfectly normal for me until I became school age. So about 5 or 6 years old, I was put into a private school with the help of my grandparents. And the kind of families I saw around me, I knew were very different than the family I had at home. Also visiting my grandparents, the kind of family that I saw my cousins living in, I knew was very different than mine. And it wasn't just a matter of I had a gay dad. It was also a matter of I only had one parent. I didn't have a mother. I didn't have siblings. And as well, we were living in a very bohemian lifestyle, that is, with multiple roommates or without a lot of money and kind of messy in a way that it wasn't like any of my peers.
Countering that, though, was the excitement that was part of 70s San Francisco and the lifestyle and the world that your father was living in.
Right. What was really exciting was my father was just getting into the poetry scene in San Francisco, which in that era had a lot of free and open readings and potlucks, and it was very much centered around community and community building. And I was a very much a part of that. So my father would take me along, but often the drawings that I would make would end up sort of on the walls of the Cloud House, which is a poetry collective he was a part of, or they made it inside of my father's books. And so there was always this sense of dress up and play and drawing and art was something that that was worthwhile and kind of serious business, and that we would share together. And that was very fun. And as well, I stayed up past my bedtime lots of times to go to readings or to parties. It was just hard for me when I had to go to school the next day and was late to school or I didn't have my homework done.
And you moved around a lot of different apartments along the way.
That's right. Between when we first moved to the city in 74 and then in 1979 when we moved into an apartment we shared in the Haight-Ashbury, we lived in about 5 residences, and you know, so one of them we only lived in for 6 months. And so it was a peripatetic life, to say the least.
How did that impact going to school? How did that impact your school life, the fact that you were living this kind of nomadic existence?
Well, it was, I think it was hard for me because I was in a bilingual school. I was in a French-American school. Mm-hmm. So I think I already felt a little bit dealing with a language barrier. And I felt that as a cultural barrier, too. Like, I felt sometimes I was lost in translation. And it made me feel sometimes at a disadvantage that I didn't, once got lost on the bus or if I didn't have my homework done. I think it made me feel a little bit self-conscious and yearning for stability as well.
What did you know or understand about your dad's work?
Well, I think when I was very young, I just knew that he was a poet and a writer and an artist, and I was, I wasn't really aware very much of the content of the work. I mean, children are pretty much always narcissists, so I liked best the poems that had my names in it, and he sometimes quoted me in his poems. And then as I got older, I think I became aware of what, if I told people my father was a writer and then they asked me his name, they didn't know his name because he was working in this sort of small community of gay writers. And so I think as a teenager, I didn't take him very seriously because I thought, well, if you're a real writer, people would know your name or you'd have be making money, and you're neither of which are true. And then as only really as I got older and especially writing this book did I come to realize just how much he contributed to the history of gay writing and just even as a role within San Francisco, encouraging other writers and artists to take themselves seriously. Like he, he really, with a lot of integrity, believed in ideas, whether or not they were to bring him money or fame. So I have a lot of respect for that now.
And as you got older, he took you to more and more places. Some of them were wild parties, but some were poetry readings and really introduced you to this world of artists and writers.
Right. When I was 12, he was invited to speak at a international poetry festival in Amsterdam, and he could have probably had me stay with friends or even with my grandparents during that period, but he decided to save up money so that I could join him. And this was my first trip to Europe, and we went to Paris and London and Amsterdam, and I met the poet Richard Brautigan and had tea with William Burroughs. And, for me, that was very exciting. And I, in hindsight, I really realized that was a gift he wanted to share with me.
How did his friends view you?
Well, when I was very little, his close boyfriends would, care for me, and they'd help take care of me, and we had real relationships. But some of the roommates, I think they saw me as, I think some of them were trying to live a life of a very immature life and trying to experiment and play and sort of in San Francisco in the 70s, it's, where you move to shake off your shackles of expectations and just experiment and try everything. Here I was, a little kid running around with my own needs and in a way it was a reminder of responsibility. So I think it was a little hard for my dad in some circumstances because he knew so few gay dads. There weren't at the era many at all. And so I think I stuck out a little bit. And then as I got older, certainly when I was a surly teenager, I don't think I made myself too many friends with my dad's writing circle. But there was a couple of men who I became friendlier with and who would come to my birthday parties or share their, introduce me to Interview magazine and things like that.
What about your girlfriends that you had at the time, and how did they view the world you lived in?
Well, it's funny because I, at the time, I thought I was hiding my father's world. I didn't feel very comfortable having friends over at my house because my house was always so much messier. I'd really preferred to spend the night at other people's house. And then as a teenager, I lived on the corner of Haight and Ashbury. I had a balcony. It was kind of a cool place to hang out as well. My dad was often not home, so we had a lot of freedom. But when friends came over, I really didn't want them to go into my dad's room. I really tried to hide the gay magazines and sort of evidence of his lifestyle, not because I was ashamed of him, but because I wasn't sure what they would think of me, and I just wasn't ready to be open in that way. And I had thought that I could keep that hidden, but in fact, as I was researching the book and talking with a lot of my friends at the time, they said they thought my dad was gay because there was never any women around, there were only men, and they did recognize some of the papers, and that they honestly they didn't think that was that big a deal. I think that was that sense of fear. Some of that was just in my own mind.
And as you were, as you say, a normal, surly teenager, talk about how that impacted your relationship with your father. How did that go during your teenage years?
Well, we had a very rough patch in my right. teenage years. We lived in the Haight-Ashbury in a one-bedroom apartment. He lived in a living room that doubled as his bedroom at night, and I had the bedroom to myself. So we didn't have a lot of space physically. And then at the point, when I was a teenager, my father was entering Narcotics Anonymous. He was getting sober, and he was embracing Buddhism as a way to sort of clear his mind and find tranquility. But all this was happening just at the point when I was discovering drugs and alcohol, as teenagers sometimes do. And I was not a very tranquil character in his life. So I think his needs and my needs were at odds. And we clashed a lot, and I spent the night at, other friends' homes sometimes to be away from him. But, you know, through that all, we still very much loved each other and felt very close together. But there was a period where I think he questioned how much, if he had the wherewithal to take care of me in some ways.
What surprised you the most, particularly about this period, that you found out in reading these journals and diaries?
Well, I think what surprised me was that at one point when he was feeling sort of at the end of his tether, he had said to me, "I want you to start meditating every day," because that's what he was doing, "and if you don't agree to do that, I'm going to move you to your grandparents." And in that period, I realized in his journals that I think someone, maybe a sponsor of his from the 12-step program or maybe another counselor he was working with, had suggested to him that I might be better served in foster care. And that really shocked me because I was never made aware of that as a teenager. I think it would have probably really scared me if I had been aware of it, but I didn't know that it had gotten that bad, that he felt that was struggling quite that much with the responsibility of caring for me.
Also in your teens, you started seeing some of your father's friends getting really sick.
Right. That was, anyone who is watching TV and reading magazines in the 80s was aware of the AIDS crisis, especially after 1985 when Rock Hudson came forward and suddenly it seemed that it was everywhere. And I think I was, because I knew my father was gay and it was so closely aligned with the gay community, I was definitely very scared and felt that vulnerable. And then as we, slowly some people that we knew, friends, and then just people in the neighborhood did start to get sick. But I think I wasn't, As a teenager living at home, I think I wasn't very aware always of. I think I was a little scared of what was going on, and so I think I might have tried to insulate myself or block that out. And it really wasn't until visits home at college that I noticed how much the AIDS crisis had changed our community and our neighborhood. And that eventually my dad would be HIV positive.
And it was really, you were away. You were in New York or France when your dad said, "Time to come home."
That's right. I was living in my junior year up in France, and he had already been writing me letters. I knew that he had his T-cell count was falling, and he was supposed to visit me in Paris. And his first trip he had canceled because of a complication related to the CMV retinitis, which is an AIDS-related condition that makes people go blind. He had to cancel his trip, and then he rescheduled it and came out again against his doctor's orders and the advice of some friends because he wanted to tell me he wanted me to move home. And so we had this conversation in Paris, and he basically said, you should be prepared to graduate early. Do you have money saved up? You might, you know, I now have full-blown AIDS. And so that was, you know, that was laid out pretty clearly for me.
And how did you see your responsibility to him at that point?
Well, at that point, I think the news came as a shock to me. I mean, I had been aware that he was HIV positive and then that he had AIDS-related condition, but, you know, it was still very confusing to me the way you understood AIDS in that era, in these sort of stages of living with HIV, and was different than dying of AIDS. It had to do with sort of what symptoms that you had that moved you into these different categories. And so I think I let myself be a little confused by that. And my father as well, in some of his letters to me, would sort of downplay the drama and sadness because he didn't want to impact my experience at school. So by the time he came out, I was a little unprepared, or not so much unprepared, but I was just not ready. And I knew that I couldn't shirk this responsibility. I knew that because my father at that point didn't have a long-term lover and he wasn't very close with his family, I knew that the responsibility of caring for him came down to me, but I still had a hard time grasping what that meant, when I would have to come home, for how long I would have to come home, and just grasping the fact that he would die. You know, he was my mother, my father, my brother, my sister. I mean, he was my entire family. That was a very hard fact to accept.
What did you know about all of these journals and diaries that he had?
I had always known he kept journals because I could see him scribbling in them in the evenings. And when I was a girl, I would sometimes look for journals that I knew had descriptions of me as a little girl. I think I was, you know, I didn't have a mother, and I was always very interested in, like, what I would have been like as a child. And so I would look up myself, but I didn't know how many journals he had until after he died, and I stumbled into a big stack of journals in the closet I was cleaning out, and then I discovered journals describing my parents' life together that I'd never seen before. And then in the process of writing this book, I read the journals very closely in a way I hadn't before. So encountered information that was new to me.
Talk about what that experience was like, reading those journals and essentially reliving your life from a very different perspective.
Well, sometimes it was very interesting because I would recall events, and it was very interesting to see his version, you know, how he would remember the event differently than I did. Sometimes as a memoirist, it was incredibly helpful because he was a writer, so he would write down lots of dialogue, things we would say, and really fine descriptions of our environment, of the people we knew. And sometimes it was very hard because there were periods when he was struggling financially or that he felt very lonely, and it was hard to read about him being sad in ways that he didn't reveal to me in the letters. Like the letters of the same period of some of those journals, he'd be very chipper and really focus on the positive, and then it was hard for me to see maybe he was struggling, and I wish I'd known that, or I wish I could help him now. And, you know, certainly the kind of things that you tell a loved one is not the kind of things you're going to write in your private journals. And so I felt like I had to take a lot of what he wrote with a grain of salt, knowing that, you know, these are journals. They weren't necessarily intended for me, and I had to respect the spirit in which they were written. And, you know, I felt because of the, you know, I'm a mother of two now, and I'm in my early 40s, I felt like I could bring a lot of understanding and forgiveness for his struggles and compassion for him in a way that even if I'd worked on this book 10 or 15 years ago, I don't think I would have been able to do.
And what did you learn as you look back on what you learned from him and all the other writers and artists that you met in that period? What did you learn about the creative process that helps you today?
Well, it's in my dad's letters to me. He really did envision and hope that I would become a writer, and he would really point me to, I really like your writing here, but here's a way you might be able to improve it, or, you know, here's, if you want to take yourself seriously as a writer, you know, read this kind of work, and you have to be willing to take risks and fail. I really felt his engagement in my future. But I think more than that, I really learned that, you know, the point of writing and the point of work isn't just to gain status for oneself, though, you know, some people are motivated by that, but, you know, it should be serving a larger cause. And, you know, I found one of my dad's letters, he wrote about seeing me right after I was born from behind a glass and kind of wondering what my life would be and sort of considering naming me Angela after Angela Davis, who was very big at the time as a in the Black Panther movement. And he had this idea. He's like, I really hoped you would take the world by the ears and, you know, really fight the good fight. And so it this idea that, like, you should be fighting the good fight and you should be serving ideas and not just oneself. I feel like I really came away from this process wanting to kind of keep that always in mind.
And how much of the way you look at your life and the way you turned out do you attribute to your strength and your resiliency and wonder that somebody else not as strong or not as resilient in your situation might have turned out very differently?
Well, I don't really think I see myself in those terms of being necessarily so strong or resilient. I mean, I survived. I think a lot of times people just do what they have to do to survive. But I think what really helped me, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, friends, some of whom have really struggled, even though both their parents are alive, is that it was very clear to me that my father loved me, and I really never had a doubt about that. And even revisiting his journals and especially the letters he wrote to me, he was so forthright in his love that I really have confidence in that. And and I think, you know, if you're really loved by a parent, that can sort of stay with you long after they are no longer with you. And so I guess I'm thankful for that. And as well, I think it also helped that my grandparents were involved in my life, and I was able to, you know, get a good education. But, you know, like I said, I don't necessarily see myself as so strong and resilient. But you know, I feel grateful. I feel, even though I only had my father for half of my life, like I had a lot of love from him.
Alicia Abbott, the book is Fairyland, a memoir of my father. Alicia, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.